Lakeisha Benjamin was a senior in high school at LaGuardia in New York when she got a phone call from the late trumpet master Clark Terry. She was only a few years into playing jazz saxophone at the time, but already she had piqued the interest of the octogenarian legend. Clark Terry, for his part, was known as one of the great mentors in jazz. Countless musicians have stories that begin with an unexpected phone call from him. In fact, his relationship with one young musician, the pianist Justin Coughlin, was even documented in a film called Keep On Keepin' On in 2014. Lakeisha herself had decided to pursue jazz in earnest after hearing Clark Terry solo on a Duke Ellington record. So when the voice on the other end of the phone announced itself as Clark Terry, she did the only sensible thing she could think to do. She hung up. It just seemed too implausible that it would be him. But fortunately, he called back, and the conversation that followed opened a door that would help to shape the rest of her life. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. After putting in time in Clark Terry's Young Titans of Jazz band, Lakeisha went on to work with an extraordinarily wide range of artists, from the Count Basie Orchestra and Harry Belafonte to Stevie Wonder, Prince, and Kool & the Gang. Her musical world is expansive. It includes jazz, funk, hip-hop, and R&B. Today, Lakeisha is one of the most dynamic voices in jazz. She's an exciting live performer whose music brings together both showmanship and depth. After putting in years working with bigger name artists and leaning into a more funk-oriented sound, in 2020 she released Pursuance, The Coltranes, a project honoring John and Alice Coltrane as parallel creative forces. It came out during the pandemic, and it was a turning point. It reconnected her music to lineage, to spirituality, and a deeper sense of purpose. And she followed that with Phoenix, which was recorded after she survived a near-fatal car accident. And shortly after that, she released Phoenix Reimagined, a live companion album. Together, those projects earned her multiple Grammy nominations, and they introduced her to a wider audience. Benjamin's most recent album, We Dream, is in many ways the culmination of her journey so far. It brings together jazz, hip-hop, R&B, and spoken word into what she describes as genreless music. And it features collaborators ranging from Terrence Blanchard, Chief Adjua, and Chris Potter, to Black Thought, Bilal, Hiromi, and Casa Overall, all of whom she describes as genreless in their own way. What I love about Lakeisha is the way she holds the line between the old school and the new, the tradition of mentorship she inherited from musicians like Clark Terry, and a musical outlook that remains completely open to whatever comes next. We talked recently about her first professional experiences and how the mentors, the heroes, the setbacks, and the inspirations that shaped her story continue to inform her today. Third-story.com is the place to explore the archive with hundreds of conversations, including many of Lakeisha's friends and collaborators, among them Chris Potter, Casa Overall, Keon Harold, Dee Dee Bridgewater, Brandy Younger, and many more. You can also visit the Substack, leosidran.substack.com, for essays, episodes, observations, and the occasional questionable life decision. And remember that The Third Story is made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for all of their award-winning podcasts. Lakeisha Benjamin is on tour in Europe this month in support of We Dream, and I'm heading there myself for a month of concerts with my dad, Ben Sidran, and with Leonor Watling. You can find all those dates at leosidran.com. But for now, here's me and Lakeisha Benjamin, zooming it up and talking it down.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, good. How are you?
I'm doing okay.
I was just on your website and I saw that you are heading out of town today or tomorrow.
Yeah.
I saw your routing is all over the place for the next couple months.
Yeah, it's a little wacky.
But how's it feel?
Like it's a little wacky.
Well, I want to talk about a few things, but the first thing is, tell me about just what the environment was like, the scene was like when you were a kid, both musically and just kind of, you know, your neighborhood.
Neighborhood, I'm from Washington Heights, 186th Street. So, as you can imagine, back then, I mean, talking early 2000s, I was a predominantly Dominican neighborhood. So, merengue nonstop. Like, even for me to get into music, you know, when I started into the band, we were playing like Oye Como Va at the block party. We were playing like classic merengue songs there. And then later someone introduced me to it as we started to get more advanced. Like, hey, you need to check out some of these songs. And then I went to LaGuardia. Bob Stewart was there. So by default, things are getting deeper and deeper. But I did start out with that, I guess, when I was going to audition to go to LaGuardia, because the school that I was zoned to go to, I figured this is terrible. I might not make it out alive here. So my friends had went to LaGuardia and they recommended this. They were older than me. And when I went to the audition, Bob Stewart auditioned me and I played a bunch of Latin music. And he was like, "What do you have going on?" I was like, "I'm just doing the best I can to get into this school and I'll do whatever I can." And he was like, "Have you ever heard of jazz?" And I was like, "No." And he's like, "I need a lead alto player for next year. My whole band is graduating." I came in on alto saxophone, I think playing a classical etude. And then I think I played Yardbird Suite because my friend gave it to me and said, "They're going to test you in a jazz song." But I played it like a mambo. Yeah. So he was like listening to me, probably thinking, "What in the world is happening?" And then he said, "You know what? Can I give you 5 recommendations? And you go home and listen to this. And if you like it, here's my personal number. Call me and I will put you into the school." I don't know if that's legal or not, but he said at the time. And I told my mom about it, and she got me these things, and it was a Duke Ellington one, Charles Mingus Big Band, Kenny Garrett songbook. There was a John Coltrane live one, but I'd never heard a live album, so I just put it on the side because I was like, "This is terrible." And I can't remember the other one. And I started with the Coltrane one, and I took it off right away. I was like, "Oh, it's broken. There's people screaming." But that's because it's live and I didn't know. Then I put the Duke Ellington one on, and right away, first solo is Clark Terry. I opened the liner notes and I was like, "Oh, I'm in." It started like that for me. That's how I really got into it. I put on the Mingus one and I asked them when I called, I said, "I'm 100% down. What should I do to prepare to come into the school in September?" It's probably around like March. He said, "Yeah, just learn the albums," and hung up. So I started trying to, I guess I didn't know, transcribe what I was hearing. I didn't know what was a solo, what was this. I was learning it from the top to the bottom. Because nobody gave a guidance. This is a solo. This is the melody. So I was just learning every single thing that I heard happening for all 5 of these albums. So when I came to the school, he was like, "Did you learn jazz yet?" And I was like, "Yeah, I learned it from top to bottom." And he's like, "Go ahead and play for me." And I played the songs from top to bottom. And he just laughed. And I was like, "There you go. You're ready."
Did you ever tell Clark Terry that was the first solo that you heard on the first jazz record that you put on?
Yeah, so around my senior year in high school, I got a call on the phone. I was living in my grandma's house. And she was like, "There's a man on the phone for you." And I was like, "Okay." She was like, "Why is there a man calling here?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't know." So I pick up the phone. And he's like, "Yeah, this is Clark Terry." So I hung up. I was like, "Get out of here." Calls back. "You hear what I say?" I was like, "Prove you're Clark Terry, sir." And he starts playing something. And you know Clark Terry has that tone that you know it right away. So I said, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." He was like, okay. He told me what he was doing. He's starting to try to start this band out. And he needs me to come to his house to audition. And he's like, "Have you ever been to Jersey?" And I was like, "No." He's like, "Good. Take this address down." I write it down. He's like, "You got an hour to get here." And I was like, "What?" I never knew where Jersey was. I was calling all kinds of like the little bootleg car services. And they were like, "We can't take you, $20. I was like, "Please, please, please." I got somebody to take me without the $20. I go in there. Gwen Terry opens the door. She's like, "Hey, Lakeisha, Clark's in the basement." I said, "Oh, no, ma'am, I don't go to the basement." She's like, "You going today?" I was like, no. So she opens the door to the basement and goes, I guess, to make tea or whatever she's doing. I take my sax out the case. I'm holding it upside down, like kind of like a little bat, like a golf club. I'm going down the stairs, like one by one, just looking down there. Like, I don't know what's going on, but I'm going to be prepared. I'm from Washington Heights. Clark Terry sees me coming down the stairs and he looks at me and goes, "What the hell are you doing?" I was like, "I don't know." And he starts laughing. He's like, "Were you going to hit me with that?" I was like, "I don't even know. I never been in the basement." And he starts laughing and he has like the music on a music stand. He's like, "Sit over there and play this song." I was like, "I'm sorry." So I set up the rest of the sax. And he's looking at me like, "What is this?" I look at the song. I scan it over. I say, "You just want me to play this?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay." So I'm about to play it. Then I stop. And I was like, "You know what?" I was like, "You the boss, right?" He's like, "I'm the boss." I was like, "Can you count this off?" He's like, "That's good." And he goes completely into the most energy. I never heard this in my life. I was like, "Oh my God." He was like, "You ready?" I was like, "I'm ready. Are you ready?" He's like, "Yeah." He's like, "1, 2, 3. The song is called Etoile, y'all. The D flat shuffle. I know that now, but then that's what it was. I play the first 4 bars. He stops me. He's like, "Yeah, that's good. You got the gig." I was like, "That's it?" He's like, "Yeah, you want there to be more?" I was like, no. So he asks me, "Oh yeah. Have you ever heard me play before?" I was like, "Yeah, I've been learning all your solos." So I start playing them for him. He's like, get out of here. Then he just starts playing like around on his trumpet. So I can hear like, oh, he's playing the blues.
Yeah.
So I start walking the bass line with him. We play for about 2.5 hours, just random songs he's going through. And at the end, I was like, was that the real test? He was like, yeah. And then that was it. He was like, you know, we're going to Switzerland to play a show out there. You know where that is? I was like, no. He's like, you know where Europe is? I was like, no. He's like, get a passport and I'll see you later. And I was like, what's a passport? And he just sends me upstairs. So I go home and tell my grandma, I need a passport. I'm getting out of here.
Oh my goodness. What a story. I mean, for just, I don't go in the basement alone is amazing.
Well, I knew like, that's not what you do.
Well, and it also speaks to this other thing, you know, I think in the past when I've talked to women in jazz, female musicians, it's always been from the point of view of like, I don't know, some kind of theoretical thing. I had a great talk with Terry Lynn Carrington last year about all this stuff. But like thinking about it from the point of view of a young senior in high school and your grandma is just saying, why is there a man on the phone? There's a strange man on the phone for my granddaughter. And now she's going to go in his basement in New Jersey. Just the amount of vulnerability and risk and unknown that you had to go into at that time in your life.
Yes. I mean, my grandma's not here anymore, but she's very Pentecostal, old school. Like, you know, if Jesus ain't on the phone, she don't want you to be talking to them.
Just from a personal point of view, what was that like for you to be sent out into a largely male world and a largely older world? You know,
it's still that. Yeah. I mean, it's actually something that now that I'm having women come up to me and ask me for a system of what to do, where I didn't think about it at the time. And I've talked to Terry Lynn Carrington about this. At the time, I spent so much time without even knowing it, trying to almost make myself invisible. Like if I'm going to a jam session, I have on sweatpants, 2 hoodies. And like, you know, I'm zipped up and I'm taking my solo with the hoodies on to try to blend in and not draw any attention to myself. Because part of me realizes that it's a male dominated field. But in order to get the tradition and the language of it, this is where it's coming from. You need to at least start right here to understand what's going on, what's happening. And these people are also the people you're going to need to play with and hang out with. And if they do not like you, you will never go on a tour where they have to want to spend 2 weeks around you, 3 weeks around you. But you also want them to not, in the 3 weeks, remember, oh, you're a lady. You know, so you're trying to balance this situation the whole time. And At the time, I didn't even see it like that. I was so tunnel vision, like, I'm in a solo. I don't care if the jam session is at 12 at midnight. I'm there. So, yeah. In my upbringing, I realized I've taken so many risks going to this studio, going to this basement, being a fat cat 3 a.m. with just 7 guys and a dog, you know, like hoping for the best. My roommates have always been at the time 5 to 6 guys at a time. We're jamming in the house like. Luckily, most of my situations were cool. But now that I see young women coming up asking me these questions, I have to think like, whoa, wait a minute.
And now, would you advise young women to do what you did? To take those same risks?
I advise them in different ways now. So I do realize there is a certain amount of putting a superhero cape that is going to be needed. But I try to shield as much as possible. So let's say you're 13 coming up. Learning the blues, you need to play, you need to try to go to jam sessions. They're all happening at midnight. So the first thing I tell them is like, okay, we love Spike. He's got Smalls, right? Go online before you even intend to go and watch these live stream jams. So much so that when the jam comes on, you know who that leader is. You know who that's the piano player that's always talking trash. That's the violin player that gets lost. Know the surroundings. Write down the songs that they're playing. So that when you come in, you know this is what they play at this place. Like, I couldn't do that. I had to go there and fall on my face. But you can now do that. After that, I put my girls in a mentor system, like a buddy system. You don't go by yourself. 2 of you go. 3 of you go. And no matter who you meet, no matter what happens, you go home together. You go home to Sarah's house. And from Sarah's house, you take an Uber or a cab or somebody picks you up and you go back to your house. And then you go down there and you play the same song together, whatever. And they can't get rid of you. You're both the same person and you can start to deal with them. If in that situation still you're having a problem, I can assure you when I get off the road, I will come down in there together with you.
Yeah.
And if they're not letting you play, I'll be talking to the band leader while you'll be soloing. And I'm willing to take that blow for you. Let's see if he can control me. But by the time we get through that talk, you'll be 3 choruses in of A-Train. So, you know, I tell them to buddy up. I tell them is for the ones that I can't talk to all the time, we talk on Instagram all the time, even with their parents in the chat, like, hey, just so they can understand, this happened to me at a gig today. Was this discrimination? Hey, sorry, fortunately, it wasn't discrimination. You can't play a blues yet. They think you're playing wrong. You're in the wrong key. You know, so just to give them an idea, but I am mindful about it. But I always tell people the first thing you need is a mentor that looks like you in some capacity that has gone through it enough to tell you, stop here, go here. That for females, everybody needs a mentor, but especially for my female students, it's crucial.
But did you have a female mentor?
No, I was just out there on the streets in the basement with the baseball bat sacks. Me and Clark, you know, I met Rashid Ali in the basement as well. Like, you know, like I just was like lucking on things and maybe, you know, the heavens were moving me through my path. And like I said, there were times where things did not go appropriately and I've had to wield myself out of other situations. But I guess the idea is not, I had to go through a rough, so good luck, girl. The idea is like, hey, if I can give you some pointers, it's not going to be easy road. But if I can help along the way, maybe if you have it almost like, if I go through a door that a woman hasn't gone through before, make sure to leave it cracked at least so that everyone can run through. And even if I don't get through the door, but I open it and it's not meant for me to go through that, I'm never going to get that accolade. I would love to be sitting around 85 and all of my students have gotten it.
Talking to you, I do get the sense that some of it is personality and just disposition. Like, you know, you seem kind of fearless in a way. And you seem also just like willing to say what you see. And the fact that you refuse to go in the basement is very telling to me, because it's like, you're at Clark Terry's house and you're still just like, no, I can tell you have a strong sense of yourself and a strong character, and everybody's personality is different. Some people are less willing to hold their own ground. And
it grew with time. I mean, the basement thing I think was easier because I'm from, like I said, like not a so well off neighborhood. Yeah. So, you know, at any age group, in any profession, the basement is bad for a man, a woman, a dog, or even a rat. You're done in that basement, you know, so that helped. But the thing that I do always tell people is that while my disposition is growing stronger and stronger over the years from these weird risks that I'm taking, I started off a shy person that when I was asked a solo would cry because I was so scared to take a solo. I was like, I'm never going to be able to do that. Can't I just play my part? Like, I just wanted to be in a big band, play my part, and go home and be the best section leader I could be and read the music and have fun. But I was like, I'm not creative like that. How am I going to, I don't have anything to say. So my first teachers were like, you know, they would say, hey, take a solo. I'm like, no, please. We would have arguments about this. So a lot of them come to my shows now and they're like, isn't this crazy? I'm like, I understand what you're saying, because I was so, I try to tell them that, like, even though you seem completely shy right now, you don't really know who you are until you give yourself an opportunity to keep growing in the steps. So right now you look shy. You have I had a small tone. It was very quiet. I had a teacher that when I would play my parts, he would yell at me, I can't hear you. And I keep playing louder. And I thought this guy is a pain in the butt. But I understood now, as I'm a big tone person, what's happening. So I always tell you, 13, 14, I don't care, 17, you don't even know who you are. Yeah. So don't be so quick to decide that you're super shy and this and that. Yeah, maybe you are, but there's a place in the music business for shy people.
Sure.
You don't have to be on stage in all gold. You can put it in all black in a chair. You're fine, you know, so.
Well, okay. So yes, before we talk about all gold, what was the process of figuring out what you did have to say and learning how to take a solo, finding your sound, figuring out what your style was going to be?
I think the one thing that is something that stayed consistent with me is, if you give me an inch, I'll take a mile. You know, so if I took a little solo, and I remember the first time I took a solo, I had a Tasmanian devil shirt on and some sunglasses, and I completely messed it up. And in the middle of the solo, when I messed it up, I started doing a little dance to try to get myself back, and the audience cheered. So that did not help my solo, but I thought in my head, okay, well, I could still get the audience on my side. So I was like, okay, so what do I need to work on? The solo, because the audience is already with me. So each little mistake that I've always made, if I do a show and maybe they like the Coltrane portion, but not my own music, I'm like, what about the Coltrane portion? Is it the legacy behind it? Is it the intensity I have? I've always had a thing where each time I do something, if I release a record and nobody likes it, why didn't they like it? I may not be in the best place always, but I'm always moving towards something. So that gives me a lot of, I guess, confidence to know that if I make a record and no one likes it, I have a better one coming. You know, so I'm not afraid to have something come out. And let's say Josh Rubin says, I don't like that. She's not a good sax player. Okay, you're right. I'm not a good saxophone player April 16th. But maybe you'll think I'm a good sax player April 20th. Mm-hmm. I'm not afraid to go up to somebody and say, hey, I heard you didn't like how I played. What do you feel I can do to be better so that it would be more in the tradition or more of what you hear? Is it my technique? And have them tell me. I'm not afraid to stand next to Chris Potter playing for his God life. I was like, this is crazy how much he is shredding in this session. You have to be willing to stand next to someone that you feel is light years more experienced and better than you and fight for your life next to them. And it's only going to keep making you better and keep putting yourself in a situation. The man is playing my song better than me. So I'm like listening to him learning how to play better on my song because we just wrote it. You know, you have to be comfortable knowing, like, don't let that hit you. Like, you know, you start to get insecure and like, well, this is my session. This, I'm the star. It's always about the music. Surround yourself with people. If you don't surround yourself with people that are better than you, how do you know how to be better?
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. If you don't surround yourself with people that are better than you, how will you ever know how to be better? I also think, regardless of whatever the details of how you get certain people on your record and whatever it costs or how you, but it also is very telling that somebody like Chris at this stage in his career doesn't have to say yes, and that it says a lot about him and all the greats that choose to be on records of younger artists or whatever it is. That's a way of also of signaling like it is important. I think this person is important. I think it's important to stay fresh in the music and not turn into a fossil with what you think is good.
I agree. I mean, to me, when you asked me earlier, how did I learn to be this way? And I started out even seeking out guests because I was looking for mentors. I was like, I don't know Dee Dee Bridgewater, but I want to know her and I like what she's about. I'm going to stalk her and try to get her eventually to be on my record, you know? But we, like I said, we live in a time frame where some of my sax teachers that I had, Gary Bard, Steve Wilson, all of them, taught me that they would go see Coltrane. They would go see Pharoah Sanders and talk to them after the show or talk to them on the gig, and they formed a friendship. And especially with COVID, everything going on, I'm like, who can I talk to? I can't find Kenny Barron so easily. I can't find Fred Hirsch. Where's Esperanza? She's in the wind, right? So you only know about them when they're playing. So I was like, in order for me to get what people got for me, I may have to start creating an atmosphere for myself where I'm not only setting up my records and what I want to do, my vision, but also getting my lessons through a career path. So that's how I started getting these guests. I wanted mentors. So, I thought it'd be cool to have Wayne Shorter or Angela Davis to talk to.
It's really deep. But my understanding is during the pandemic, that is when you started to kind of reorient your career and in some ways embrace making a more jazz focused project.
Like absolutely.
That's when you did your Coltrane's project. It was during COVID.
Yeah, I was getting my master's at NJCU. And so let's say right before the pandemic happens and I had to do like a dissertation. They were like, you're going to, because you completed all your work, you got to submit an album. I was like, what? That's not real. Like, that's not fair. And then I was like, I'm not a person that does albums, do albums.
Yeah.
So I thought they just said you have to submit the tracks, but it got my mind thinking. And I was like, you know, at the time I had been doing a lot of my funk project.
Yeah.
And not only was it not really successful or going anywhere, I was getting, unfortunately, a little bummed out, just E flat minor jam, everybody in the crowd. I was like, I'm actually starting to become a worse player. Because I'm using less of what I had and I've lost what I had. Mm-hmm. So I was like, what's a good way to, I guess, get back to what got me into the music and challenge myself? And I was like, there's no bigger challenge than John and Alice. Mm-hmm. So that's what started me. And besides, you know, just playing both of their music, I thought, of course, I got to talk to Reggie. He's the one who put me into the New School. As I was talking about it and doing it, I started thinking, how many people that played with that Coltrane are still alive? And then it started me down this path of thinking, would love to meet Ron Carter, would love to. Then it started becoming, you know, at first it started as, I'm maybe not going to be a band leader. Maybe nobody wants to hear my music. I'm not getting any reviews. Critics are not talking about me. I'm not playing mini gigs I'm playing the stars, but not as my own thing. So maybe I'm going to have to segue and accept that this is what I'm good at and find a way there. But if I'm going to do that, let me try one last bang. And see, will it stick? You know, before I throw it all up, let's put it all out there. A dream project. I have $100 in the bank. Let's see how it works. And luckily, that project did do well despite like the chaos that came from the pandemic. It seemed like the project really started fueling the next thing. So once I told you, once I get an inch, I take a mile. I was like, let me call Terry. I got another project I got in mind that seems like, how could I get these stars to play with me? And it just kept, so I just kept the process. I was like, let's keep going and see how far I can get to it. So that's how we got to this.
You said earlier that when you started going to jam sessions or whatever, you would wear two hoodies and hide yourself because you didn't want to call attention to yourself personally. You just wanted to play the solo and whatever, if I'm understanding. Like, you wanted to do everything to just blend in.
I wish I was actively thinking this, but I wasn't. This is me reflecting now, thinking probably what was happening. I think the overall goal is just be one of the guys.
Yeah.
Be like a girl's guy, you know, like the friend they love, the little sister they love having around. She's cool. Oh, she's just trying to learn. They're showing me little things. Hey, you heard about this jam session downtown? I also need the inside. Where do I need to go?
Yeah.
What's going on? We're doing the jam session at blah, blah, blah's house. You want to come? Oh, I just started playing with Roy Hargrove. You want to come meet him? Like, those are the I'm just trying to put myself in a neutral place.
Yeah.
Where my personality maybe can shine so much. And, yes, and my dedication, I think that's what I was thinking.
But it does seem that you did stand out. Anyway, what I'm curious about is how you ended up, as you mentioned, playing with stars. Like, one of the things that you had in your career was that you started playing outside of the quote-unquote jazz world with pop, R&B, hip-hop, way more mainstream. How does that happen to somebody who's just trying to stand in the corner and be a guy's girl?
So we have to divide the career, right? So yeah. There was that drastic thing I did that started me having all these jazz legend guests and restarting my jazz career and getting back in the shed and the grind and all this that's created now. There was also a period, like I said, where the Soul Squad music was not going well. And also, bills are starting to come up. I'm out of school now. I'm like, whoa, life is moving. I had a job at the supermarket, this. And also at the same time, a lot of my friends and peers are like calling me. Yeah, I'm in Paris with Roy Hargrove. I'm like, damn, I'm at, you know,
the supermarket.
Yeah, D'Agostino. You know, bag and stuff. You know, and then they're like, I would get like a little tiny tour, like at the State Department in Haiti or like, you know, really far off in the world. And they'd be like, yeah, I'm at the North Sea Jazz Fest. And I'm like, damn, what's going on? So I started realizing quickly, I'm not sure if I don't have what it takes, but I'm sure I don't know who it takes. So I made a pact with myself to do like the wildest stuff. If I found out Stevie Wonder was playing somewhere, I'm going to go to the show and try to jump on his set. If I found out Prince is playing somewhere, I'm going to jump on the set. Like, that became my thing. And people knew, like, this girl is going to come and disrupt our gig.
How do you do that?
There were times there was very little success. And there were times there was enormous success. Right? So there are times that just the things that happen in life where you're playing with a little party band, like, what's a good instance? Playing with the party band, we're doing, before Barack Obama's inauguration, we're doing a tribute to Maya Angelou because she's getting a Lifetime Achievement Award. So my friend just got us this gig. We're going to play nothing but R&B standards and covers. And, you know, people are dancing, D.C. Everyone's happy. Obama's coming. You know, boom. Maya Angelou goes, I'm like, wow, I've lived the best life I ever had. Mm-hmm. Someone talks to us after the show and was like, you guys, band, you want to go play with Stevie Wonder right now? You can't take your coats, anything. And I look at the band leader, who's a friend of mine. I'm like, what are we going to do? He's like, let's go. I was like, we can't take our coats. It's like negative 20. We go running to this Commerce Building or wherever it is. They have instruments set up. Go play, play, play right now. Cue sax, cue sax. I'm like... We get up there and start playing. The audience is dancing. We're doing party music. That's all we know, party music. Man, I don't see Stevie Wonder. I'm looking at my watch. I'm like, it's 2 hours to party music. I don't have another Prince song in me. But sure enough, right when I'm saying those comments to the band trying to get us out, I see the little half dreadlock forehead. I'm like, that's Stevie. He comes out and his piano is set up right next to the sax platform. He starts playing a song. I can't remember what it was. I know every Stevie Wonder song alive. I'm playing with him. I'm Gucci. Yeah, great. Good job. Stevie Wonder, they try to pick him up to walk him off to get his award and leave. He won't leave. He starts playing another song. Then he starts playing another song. Then he's going through his repertoire. It feels like testing us. So the audience, no one's going to stop Stevie Wonder from this impromptu nonstop jam. Then he goes into All I Do, which I know has a huge sax solo. Solo comes up. I'm looking at my friend that plays the piano, like, hey, bro, it's your gig.
Yeah.
You should take it. And he looks at me like, no, you got it. It's an alto thing. I was like, no, bro, you should take it. Huh. And Stevie Wonder standing right next to me goes, somebody solo. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to just play the solo from the record.
Yeah.
So I start with the solo from the record. As soon as I start, he goes, yeah. And the whole audience starts going crazy. So I play the whole solo. He says, keep going. So now I'm playing my own solo. And he's rocking. He's right next to me. We're rocking hard. Yeah. After the set, he takes my number. He's like, yeah, I'm going to give you a call for a gig. I'm like, okay. But no, he surely does. And like certain things like that, the combination of me jumping on the Prince stage, like that went well for me. It looked like it was going to suck, but it went well.
You got to tell me the story.
We don't have enough time for these. But the bottom line is stuff got terrible, man. I was really just taking a risk. If I knew that you were somebody I wanted to play with and I respected and you had a gig, I was willing to jump on your stage. And if the security got me, cool. If not, but after a while, when I was first playing those first hip hop gigs with Missy and everybody that I've met through those kind of circumstances, they started thinking I was a horn section MD. Mm-hmm. So I would get the trumpet, trombone together, and we would play all these gigs, and it started working out. And for a while, I thought the hip hop thing, I was like, I'm chasing the money too hard. It's too rough. Mm-hmm. So that's when I started focusing on Stevie and people that had Shaka, people that had names like that, that I felt respected the music. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got more popular as a, almost like, call this girl. She got the horns. They look good. They know all the dance steps. I was playing with Kool in the Gang. They're like, I had a good visual package. But like I said, after a while, I started to get like...
That is certainly part of the question, right? You know, if you go from, in the jazz world, you're just trying to not stand out visually. Like, I imagine that for so many of these artists, you get a young, good-looking group of musicians who are like, you know, play good, know the music, respect the music, and also just like understand the job of being on stage and making an audience happy and presenting in a certain way.
Yeah, I mean, when I started with Kooling, and that was the first gig that gave me like a tour.
Yeah.
I could get around, right? So when they first met me, it was all about the music. It's an audition. Yeah. The music, everything. They liked what I had to play. Music, he's asking me questions. Do you know who Maceo is? Do you know what this is? Have you ever heard this Dexter Gordon song? So they, luckily, the older, I guess, a pop people know music. Earth, Wind & Fire knows music.
Yeah.
So we have things in common with what I've listened to. So they were cool with me about the music and who I was. They saw my personality shine through. But definitely day two, they told me, meet this person. And I went in his wardrobe.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, oh, what am I supposed to do? They said, we're going to give you the outfit, you wear these. So I had to definitely have an agreement. Luckily, it was nothing too crazy, you know, but if it was, I probably would just say, I can't do it. But it was just like, you know, it's not too far off from how I dress now. I can be that.
How do you even get to a point where you know what your vibe is, what your stage vibe is, what your look is?
I think the experience helps. When you're playing with other people and they have something they want you to wear, you're testing it out. How do I feel in this? Do I like this? That's what I tell my students now. The sooner you know who you are, the sooner people call you to show up as yourself.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they say, hey, we're all black. Hey, nobody tells me to be a special guest what to put on. They already know, oh, she's going to come in something like this. So I think from trial and error, I think from having my own band, having to, I guess, I work closely with the same photographer the whole time. From Retox all the way now, I'm using the same exact team.
Yeah.
So they have watched me grow. They have watched me change. And we can see together like how I'm developing. And we talk about it. They listen to the music. How do we want to present ourselves for this album? And how are you going to present yourself on stage? Because I want the stage appearance to be exactly, I want the whole experience to be connected right away.
Yeah. It sounds like it's important to have people with you along the way that have seen the trajectory along with you and can be, you know, useful in terms of like, you know, not reinventing the wheel every time, but understand where you are in your career and understand what you're going for.
It's helpful. It's not like you can't do it without it because, you know, things are hard these times. It's hard to keep the same band together. It's not the good old Miles Davis days. You know, sometimes it's hard, but it does help. If you don't have the vision that's solid, I usually do. But the more, I'm a loyal person, is how I'm built. If I like you doing publicity, we're rocking as long as we can. If I like you doing my booking, I think the stronger an artist is with a team that understands that we're all looking for the same vision. And the stronger the artist is, kind of like the gas in the car. If you know how you see yourself, if you know how you see your music, if you can sit here and envision yourself on the stage, what each step of the performance looks like, how do you want the crowd to react? when somebody puts the album on, do you want them to be in a somber mood? Do you want, how do you, if those things you understand about how your music makes people feel, then you can start in a good place, because instrumental music is different than vocals. Like the vocals almost tell people, this is what's happening, this is what's going on. Instrumental is kind of like bilingual. I'm talking one language, you're talking another, and I could be doing like Rage Against the Machine in my mind, and you're like, she's such a sweet, lovely person. So the more you can involve making them feel something,
yes,
the easier it is, because I'm not saying instrumental music is impossible right now. That's not what I believe at all. But I do notice there's a different scenario between singers and instrumentalists, even in how hard they work.
Wow. Wait, say a little bit more about that before we move on.
I mean, I play with Greg Porter. He sings one lyric. They're clapping. The top of the song, they know what song it is. They love the song. It's a hit. They're singing along with it. You're playing with Stevie. They're singing word by word by word by word. I'm on stage rolling around on the floor. Clap. You know what I mean? In the beginning, you could say, you know what I mean? But you've also seen, I used to play with Hugh Masekela. One note. They know what song this is. They know what's going on. So there's a different level between people that have hits and all that stuff. But just, I've opened for Branford probably like at least 50 times now. I wouldn't say everybody knows his music. But from the jump, they feel something right away and they know, oh, that's Branford. When you hear Herbie play, you hear Chris Potter play, you even know who it is, that signature thing that they have that makes them like, soon you hear a Miles and a Mute, you go, oh, the audience starts clapping. What can you do that makes people, when they think of your artist, they hear a sound in their head?
Yes. The Hugh Masekela thing is also, I think, useful in remembering that melodies matter. Yeah, obviously a hit is helpful, but what makes something a hit? Like sometimes just having some tunes that like people can whistle or hum to themselves while they're walking down the street is so crucial.
Some tunes they can whistle. Just pick it how you want to do it. You know, I never tell anybody we're in a gimmicky sellout culture. Yeah. If your brand is like all the way high energy, John Coltrane, late years, Interstellar Space, then that's what you need to do it all the way. Like when people watch you perform it, perform that thing all the way with every ounce of heart you have in it. And then you can be known, like no one's telling Kamasi Washington, hey, sing the song. He's completely going crazy, nonstop. You got two drummers, two everythings on the stage in a dashiki. You know, so it's hard to imagine that because it's a commercialized world. But
yeah,
I do believe, and I don't want this to get misconstrued, that authenticity is important and the integrity of who you are. You know, if you're going to play like Emmanuel and be in a different thing than how I am, do it all the way and be prepared. Like, you know, maybe people get it later. Maybe they get it now. You know, the money, all of that is nice. We all want to live. But be prepared to struggle or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Be true to who you are and go all the way. Just don't be up in there, Lawrence Welk with it.
Yeah. You mentioned when that first five records that you checked out and the first solo you listened to was Clark Terry. I love that story. And then you also got this Kenny Garrett record.
Yes.
In the first collection. And that's kind of deep too, that like, because I do feel that you love Kenny Garrett.
I love him.
It's kind of cool to think like, well, it's one of the first things that you heard in the music was Kenny. And what would have happened if that hadn't been one of the first five things that you heard?
Well, the other one was a Charlie Parker record. He was like, it was a compilation. He was drawn like a cartoon.
Yeah.
This is the alto history, right? Of course, you got Johnny Hodges. You can always keep pivoting to whoever your key person is.
Yeah.
Charlie Parker is definitely one of them. Jackie McLean. You know, we have so many that are ones.
Sure.
But and this is my personal opinion. Kenny Garrett is the king of the alto. Outside of Charlie Parker, if you move forward, I mean, there's plenty of other people that you can debate it, and I agree. They all deserve their thing. But in terms of genreless, defining things, making the alto sing and talk, there's not an alto player anytime in the last 20 years that you can hear some Kenny Garrett in their sound. However he plays has defined the way we hear the alto. And it's like, even when people tell me, oh, I'm trying to learn this Kenny Garrett and get on this and be like this, they're still trying to be like 1992 Kenny Garrett. It's 2026, and when you watch the man perform, he is still better than the 1992 Kenny Garrett. So you're still 30-something years behind him and watching him tour all over the world, in shape, eating carrots, in his slick-looking suits, you know, speaking multiple languages, playing the, like, you know, so I personally feel that when Kenny Garrett's time is, you know, moved on, he is actually a landmark, almost like a Coltrane for us in terms of the alto saxophone history, in terms of like even the teachers I've studied with have studied with Kenny Garrett.
Yeah.
So I find that crazy that I'm studying with you and still you're telling me, I had a teacher once that we finished our lesson. I was like, where are you going? He's like, I'm going to go get a lesson. I was like, you still taking lessons? He's like, yeah. I was like, well, who? He goes, Kenny Garrett. And I was like, are y'all going to sit in together? And she was like, yeah. I was like, can I go see it? But I found it crazy that I'm watching my teacher fight for his life against Kenny Garrett. So I just personally believe what he's done for the language of the music and his spiritual dedication to it.
Yeah.
I don't think we've given him enough of his props as how he has defined the last probably two decades of alto.
Earlier in the conversation, you said there was that moment when people that you came up with would call you and they would be in France or they would be in Holland or they would be playing festivals and you're going, what am I doing with my life? And, you know, and I told you that before we got on the call, I looked at your schedule and that I know that you're going on the, you know, going to do a date tomorrow. And I also know that this summer, you're that person who's going to call home and say, I'm in Holland right now. I'm in France right now. I'm playing this festival. You know, that it happened. I think that that's very inspiring. Just that arc of that thing of becoming what you wanted to become, having the thing that you hoped would happen for you.
Totally. I mean, I remember being in high school with Bob Stewart and he, you know, at that time he was playing in Sam Rivers Band. He was playing in Nicholas Payton Band. He was in Osby Band. I think he was in Brass Fantasy. He was in, I forgot the name of that project, but Howard Johnson had like a million tubas.
Yeah.
I think it was Gravity. He was in that. And we would come back each year and he would have all these posters on the wall and he would tell us, this is where I went. This is where I went. This is where I went. And we were like, where is that? And he's like, this is where I went. And he would tell us what he ate and what he did. And we were just like, whoa, you're playing with James Carter. You're doing all this and all this stuff going on. So now Curtis, Bob's son, we're very good friends. And now we sit around talking about this. Do you remember when he was saying this? And now literally we're at the festivals he was talking about. So if that's not a message for like the teachers out there that you guys really matter, I don't know what is, because we're definitely the living example of what you said.
I got a chance to listen to We Dream, to your record that's coming out in June.
Oh, cool. The whole thing.
It feels like a kind of a manifesto for you. It feels like more than a record. It feels like a particular personal statement. I think people make records for a multitude of reasons, and sometimes they're small and contained and sometimes they're big. This one is very big.
Yeah, you are right. It is I've only done a couple interviews so far for the record. I mean, they've been substantial, but it is a manifesto in terms of the way I'm thinking of it. I wanted, even the reason why I had Terrence, I was thinking of a more cinematic kind of storytelling that the album would, of course, you're going through it with the audio and sonically, but that the almost the spoken word parts and the raps and all of that are constantly bringing you back to what the theme is so that you don't kind of get off topic as to your travels in the album of what we're expressing. And I guess trying to give you a picture image of the climate that we're trying to put you in as well.
Well, so let's talk about it. What did you imagine you were going to make when you set out to do it?
So each guest, for every album I've had, I write the songs for them so that they can kind of just fit in naturally versus like trying to get Terrence Blanchard to play a bebop, you know, or something like that. Each person, they had a particular role in the theme. So one of the main themes of the album was I was trying to find guests that not only are genre bending, but they also have been innovative in the way that they do it. Like the only this particular person can do it. Otherwise, I have to call another person, do a whole nother song. And I wanted people that not only are they doing that in their music, they may be reflecting that in the entrepreneurial things they have going on. Maybe they're running SF Jazz, or maybe they're running festivals, or maybe they're working with kids. They're doing things that are kind of humanitarian to kind of keep the world and I guess show younger artists that, yeah, you can be a great musician, you can be touring all over the world, but your impact and your voice also matters for your generation and the generation coming before.
That's beautiful. Where does that come from in you? You know, where do you think that impulse, that desire to be a musician, but also to use that as a tool to, I don't know, pay it forward to the next generation and to signal that you can use being a musician to a greater means? Like, where did you see that? Did people show that to you? Is that
where
you got it?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe it has to be from my mentors and my upbringing. My first gig is Clark Terry. You know, he has a huge role in educational things. And the whole reason I think that he even came across my name is he was looking for young jazz musicians to put in his band. And what he called us, Terry's Titans of Jazz. So like, that's the kind of Dee Dee Bridgewater. When you think of a Herbie Hancock, when you think of Terrence, when you think of Jason Moran, these are people that I'm watching in the Young Lions crew that I'm watching Terry Lynn Carrington now have huge impacts on not only just the music, but starting their own organizations within a school or, you know, reaching back to me, helping me produce a project, introducing me to the world of grants and how to apply. You know, some of these people are actually have spoken to me like, hey, I see you're playing the North Sea Jazz Festival. This is what that contract pays. And this is what you should be getting for someone in your age group. You know, wow. You may not be here. And I feel like those conversations are missed, especially generations right before me and definitely after me. And if we don't, I guess, operate as a community, we don't know what to expect. And the world is moving fast. AI is coming. Everything is about content on social media. So I feel like I need to quickly gather these tools and from the people that are here, while they're here, and from who they learn from, in order to be equipped that when I get to their rank and their age group, that I can truly inspire from a place of knowledge.
Yeah. Part of what you just described, I think, is a very common story of the tradition of how to run a band, how to run a career, what it's like to be on stage, how to make the music that was passed down through bands. And that has been a part of the thread going through this music all the way back to the beginning. You put your time in with a band and then you got your own, you led your own band, whatever. All that is really beautiful and learning from the elders and the masters. But the other piece that you just said, I think is maybe a little newer, which is the idea of the entrepreneurial aspect of it or just the business management of a career where it's like, the community is starting to look out for itself. And this idea that somebody would call you and say, I don't know what they're offering you, but this is what it pays. This is how you should consider organizing your career. Like that's kind of new to me in a way, actually, that's happening.
I wouldn't say that all jazz legends do this. I don't want to call any names. They're going to call me and be like, hey, Lakeisha, you should be making $100,000 or something. I'm not sure. But I have noticed it like, you know, for me, all of my training from when I played with Rashid Ali, when I played with McBride, all the people, it starts out with the music. Hey, young blood, this is what you need, how you need to play. We're on stage. I'm learning from them, watching them direct the crowd. Since I've played with R&B people and jazz people, I'm watching Stevie Wonder in 100,000 theater versus 10,000 people versus 150. So I'm learning also, okay, as a band leader, this is how I can get the audience engaged on all this kind of music. But as I started, my career started, I guess, moving quickly and elevating, real life situations started coming up. How do I manage the realness of the artistry, but still connect to the fans, right? How do I manage, like, you know, the jazz festival scene is a lot of older attendees, but still gather my generation at the festival and younger. So all of these questions started coming. And as these questions started coming, I naturally started asking the people that I look up to, and some were open-minded to it, some were not, but I'm starting to see that just like, we have a whole generation coming up here that are getting out of these jazz universities and have no clue what to do with this degree and how to start making real money. And are they going to keep their integrity in the music? We're in a political environment. Are they going to be allowed to express and reflect the times that they see? Or are they just play a song that sounds cool? You know, will people even understand that? Are they having their music, people pretending that it's them online? So I just started to realize that we're living in this kind of dystopian reality. So even when I made We Dream, I made it with the idea of like, this is where I feel the world is right now. And let's start the journey through the album of what I'm experiencing, how it's affecting me, how it's impacting me. And hopefully there can be some positivity spread from the music that's on there to hopefully we can dream of a better little place.
Because the music is serious in places, but it's also a very enjoyable record. You don't listen to it and walk away from it thinking, oh man, things are really messed up right now. You think like, oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful to be alive. Look at this wonderful collective of people that have come together to make something. So in response, so that was in some ways your response to how dark things are, was to try to
do
something light.
Yeah, I kind of gathered my own group of like Avengers.
Yeah.
And was like, these guys are some of the most positive, inspirational people I know. And just the nature of my writing, even if I feel a darkness, it always has a bit of light in it. So the idea was kind of like a bright spot in a dark place. But I did with the poetry want people to know that this is how I feel things are going. But I wanted people to walk away, even if they after show, my shows are very high energy, very inspirational. I didn't want to lose that aspect of myself within the, you know, situation.
When you brought in other vocalists and MCs and people to write, did you talk to them about what your ideas were for the record or themes that you wanted to talk about?
Absolutely. So like with vocalists, especially in the past, I have always written the lyrics, always written the melodies, and they have, like, Diane Reeves. They have the job of singing something that's not personal to them, but trying to make it their own, which is already a skill set that's like, wow, thank you. And you're grateful that people can make your music come alive. But this is the first time I've had rappers that are not me coming up with, you know, long extended lyrics of what they're going to do. Tank, that's a long extended piece. So we had to work more collaboratively about this is what I'm doing, but I do not want to inhibit your message. And the reason that I have you doing it is super crucial. So for some of the things that have clear melodies, like Right Now or something like that, it was like, yeah, definitely do this, but do your thing on that. But let's say for the rap of Right Now, it was like, you have free reign.
Years ago, I talked to Casa Overall, and he was saying, you know, saxophone players should be checking out more MCs because there's so much happening in the rhythm and in the, that, you know, I forget exactly what the quote was, but he was like, I go to these jam sessions and I just think all these saxophone players should be listening to Andre 3000. He's like, they should be transcribing that and playing that on their horns. And, you know, and when you think about, you have a record where you have as many or an equal amount, an equivalent amount of MCs who are coming as you do soloists. Like in the same way you probably wouldn't say to Sean Jones, play less notes over the second A or whatever.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's kind of the same thing when it comes to bringing in a rapper and asking them to write their what they feel over a section.
Well, the lucky part about, I guess, this particular situation with Casa, especially being one of the main rappers, is he also was a producer for at least half of it. So he's really in tune with what we're trying to do. And it's rare to have a rapper. Well, then we do have a lot of rapper producers now, but rapper producers that play the drums, that can play with Charles Lloyd, that can also play with like De La Soul, that can also. So he's also an anomaly within his own situation. I'm sure that's why they gave him a little genius grant thing. But yeah, I've always felt that in general, maybe because I came from a more Latin background at first, that the music is primarily rhythmic. And then we start to learn the harmonic things about it that make it really advanced, because of course you need the harmony to be there. But the thing that makes you, like if you try to define what a groove, it makes you move, it makes you bop, it brings you into a place. So if that is not in your saxophone solo, the notes don't even matter so much anymore, because as soon as people hear you, they're not ready to bop. So I do think that maybe it's jazz education. I don't know, that's a whole other topic, but instrumentalists should really start getting more rhythmic and what they're doing. And then, of course, the harmony matters, the scales matters, the patterns matter. But if you don't have anything to say, then we're in a time now where rap is one of the mainstream musics.
Well, you've introduced this question of education a couple times, so let's talk about it a little bit. The first thing that you said was you've got all of these students that come out of often extremely expensive institutions, saddled with debt. And when you think about the reality of what a likely career in music might look like, it's sometimes I think, in what world are these musicians going to come out and be able to pay this debt off if they're, you know, playing gigs? Like it can happen, but there's a lot of people for whom, you know, it could be really challenging. And as you say, like you spend all this time dealing with the theoretical aspects of the music and maybe don't get the education in, but how, like, what does a contract look like? How do I get an agent? What should I do career-wise? So that was the first thing that you introduced. And then the second thing you just said was, yeah, maybe there's a little bit of an overemphasis on the sort of the theoretical stuff and not just like focusing on what makes people move, what makes the body move in music. So where are you at with this kind of question of jazz education?
We're in a combo phase, right? So having jazz and education like classical and stuff like that, and jazz and performing arts centers and jazz and theaters has done more for us than we could possibly imagine. It allows us to have a livelihood. We can thank Wynton Marsalis for that 10,000 times. And I'm always grateful to him. I went to school across the street from Lincoln Center, but we just have to balance it. So, you know, a lot of the people that we look up to, they didn't go to jazz school. They went to Count Basie school. They went to Mulgrew Miller school. They went to Kenny Kirkland school. They were at the Kenny Garrett show, you know, learning from that. So we have to just balance it out a little bit. I don't think that jazz education is the wrong way, because it's an easy, safe environment. Because there's a lot of places jazz is not happening. So it's one of the few places where you can play with other like-minded people, sure. But there is nothing like watching Clark Terry count off a song. Just a simple shuffle. And watching him move that energy, watching what it takes, the kind of solo he needs to take, even though he has an army of knowledge of where he can come from. and get that crowd on their feet, get them night after night ovations. There's an energy in the music that that cannot be taught. So you have to go to school, but you have to, I guess, university of the streets it a little bit as well. You have to, unfortunately, come to a gig like mine, get mentors that you watch, go to their shows, sit in with them, feel the wind of the drums knocking you off the stage, feel Rashid Ali throwing you around because he has experienced John Coltrane punching him nonstop in the face. You know, so there's a real life, you need some battle wounds.
Yes.
To really understand it. So it's easy to say, like, you know, come out, get your content together and theorize these kind of things. But every profession right now is having high debt in schools. And you can be a doctor and you're going to get out of school and wonder, how in the world am I going to? So that's a separate thing for the economy and all that kind of stuff. But we do have to get back to why we all love jazz and what made it fun for us. When I put on my first Duke Ellington record, what made me smile? What made me go, what's that? So I think we just need a little bit more of the feeling.
Lakeisha Benjamin, it is such a treat to talk to you and to talk about We Dream and everything you're up to. But you are.
Yeah, are there any questions about We Dream you have? I mean, you heard the record. What were the songs that I guess you have the most questions about?
I'll tell you, like, I love the track with Bilal and Casa right now.
That one was the hardest one to put together. We actually did a whole track. We did the whole thing down, full band.
Yeah.
Everything. And I was like, this thing don't feel good. Mm. It just never kept feeling good. And I originally had, of course, Bilal, we were leaving a space for him.
Yeah.
And Black Thought was going to do the rap on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the schedules and the time and everything going on. And I was like, I've written this song for him. I might have to switch it around and think of what I could do. And I wanted to kind of leave the album as we start to get towards the second side of it. And a more urgent thing about what's happening right now in the world and what we feel like we're actually going through.
Right now, Mayday save my soul right now. Pele trying to set goal right now. Silver bags you can't fold right now. Never know who gonna snake then smile. End up swimming in the lake good or now. This hotel been around for a while. Please don't sleep with the beast when you got peace. They gonna wanna eat when police get found.
With Bilal, I thought of him because while I think to the regular mainstream world, he just seems like maybe like a D'Angelo protege, you know, his soul sister record. Like he's just like in one capacity, he's a star.
Yeah.
He's a star that is in a different stage of his career, but has been mainstream. Like I just watched them 2 months ago perform. How does it feel? The Grammys, you know, he was nominated there, all this stuff going on. And I do think to jazz musicians, like maybe Robert Glasper and the people that really know, Bilal's like an avant-garde jazz musician that I feel like people, they just think of him as this mainstream guy, and he really has multiple levels of himself. And I wanted to showcase, because I originally told him, I said, you don't even have to use the words. You can just be a horn if you want. You know, you can be an effect. The words are not so much important as the message. So you'll notice at point in time, he's singing definitely the words. And at point in time, you're like, what's this man saying? You can get the vibe, but you start to wonder after a while, like, wait, did he say something? I didn't understand it. You have to evaluate it. So I thought he was a perfect person to introduce like more of the pop side of myself, more of the avant-garde side of myself, more of the experimental side of me in a way that was palatable to the listener and soulful, where they're just getting the expression of it. While Casa has like a million words per mile.
I know he's got a lot to say. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I learned all the raps, everybody, because we were performing it. But
well, I was going to ask you that. When you take this out, obviously you can't take all these people with you. Like, so how do you perform a largely vocal record when you can't take those vocalists with you on the road?
I think it seems more vocal than it is.
Yeah.
Right. Because you think about it, the vocal pieces that are like in my mind impossible without that person is maybe Tank.
Yeah.
We Dream, right? Because that's a character. I can easily do that, but it's not my character, and I don't think it's authentic.
Yeah.
But in terms of outside of that, besides Bilal,
it's you.
Yeah, there's no real other song where it's like, oh, I can't.
Yeah.
We can't do that. Like, all the poetry, everything is spoken by me. But so I do feel there's some authenticity. Certain songs, we've done We Dream, just the vibe of it.
Yeah.
And I've done my own poetry on it. But usually all of our albums have had guests where we've had to fill in for them and find a way around it. And luckily, it's always in my bag anyway. So The only song I said, like I said, what could I say we haven't done so far? We haven't really done New World too much, but that's because it's slow.
I really like New World. I really like, there's a couple of little breaths of fresh air in the record. Yeah. There's that one. And there's another one in the short thing in the middle of the record that comes in.
Oh, the Hiromi Jam? If you can think about the album as like, you know, we start off with me, complete like darkness. Out of the ashes we rise, you know, just the world sucks. Terminator has happened. AI's killed us all. We're just the last of humanity, right? That's what's going on. And as you keep going through the record, since I'm trying to almost think about each guest as we're stopping in a different place. We're in New York trying to get to California. There's no more New York. So if you can think about each guest, we're stopping at a different location. And each person, that's why Flamekeeper is for Hiromi. Because that's what I feel her music and her light is in the world, right? But I also wanted to signify some of the killing studio moments we have. We have it all video, but we got into some jams with this album, boy, just because of the people we have in the room. And a lot of times I would have to leave my booth just to talk to each person, to interact with them. But you can't control a start. Hiromi's over there just jamming. Chris Potter's like, I heard that. I want to jam. Everybody's happy to play. Terrence is playing. We're like, oh, we want to play with that. So there were so many like just authentic teaching moments within the process of us playing with these stars and guests that I felt at that moment in particular, from what I knew about Hiromi, I knew a lot about her fusion stuff, her stuff with Anthony Jackson, all this stuff.
Yeah.
But it was such a grooving, you know, relaxing moment that we felt in the studio that I was like, I think the audience, because that particular track is completely improv. There is no edits. There's no, most of it, I don't ever go back and do my solos again. But that happened right in the moment.
Yes.
And it's exactly how it happened. I just started it and cut it off. I didn't even fade it. That's all I did. It just replayed the track.
I know you fade it. Exactly.
It happened right after the song. We finished all of that crazy stuff. Everybody's like, whoa, everybody's solo is crazy. And out of nowhere, she's like into it. So I was like, oh, it reminded me of like when I was like listening to those D'Angelo albums. Remember they used to have the hidden track?
Yeah.
And things would sneak in and stuff like that. So I felt it was a good segue to get to the other stuff in the album. But there were just so many moments. Like, I didn't tell Terrence, hey, play these notes behind me on First Light and it's going into Beyond the Dawn and I want you to do this. I literally read him the poem. So this is what I'll be saying. So you have that idea. And how, I guess, if you're a star, to put yourself in a place where you're like, I'm going to be behind the scenes. And just create an atmosphere because I want her to be featured. Even when we're playing the melody, he asked me to mute him on the bridge. He said, I feel like I don't want to cover you up. This is your song. It's your thing. I want you to be able to shine.
Yeah.
And why is he even thinking that? Of course, I want you to be Terrence Blanchard and do your thing. But in the process, each guest was trying to find a way.
You also chose to bring three trumpet players onto the record.
That's my love for the alto trumpet tradition. My J-Mac, my Charlie Parker, you know, my Kenny Garrett. I feel the alto and the trumpet is the number one pair. And people haven't noticed it in past albums, but that's what it always is. You know, like, but I guess the Chris Potter thing, I originally thought of it for trumpet, but then I was like, wait.
Yeah.
This is much better. But I think the alto and the trumpet share a voice. Mm-hmm. And when the harmony is changed where the trumpet's on the bottom, and the sax on the top, I think it makes a very unique kind of sound. Yeah. And I kind of, because Sean, he plays so versatile, we constantly are switching back and forth between who is on top and who, and people don't really know, unless you really listen to like a My Only, where's the melody and where is the harmony? I always want, because I love the trumpet, the baddest trumpet players. I always try to find a way. I mean, between Terrence, Chief, and Sean, I got them. You know?
Yes. And three really different approaches and sounds and concepts, you know?
Yeah. I mean, each one was for like a mi gente. I was thinking, Chief, this is kind of the phase he's in right now. He's in a real, every time I talk to him, he's going to the jungles of Brazil to find the authentic African rhythm that they're playing. So he can build an instrument to learn how to combine that with Japanese drums or something. You know, that's always been what I've known him to be on.
Yeah.
So since this one was more of a tribute to my Heights background,
Yes.
And just the combination of that and jazz and kind of the Machito era with the Dizzy era, I wanted him in that. And I was, I gave him the choice. You can play your own instrument, however you want to do it. But this is where you are in the song. So I was trying to think of everybody for what they are. You know, I think of Sean Jones mainly as a shredder.
Yeah.
But a lyrical one. So I put him on the Dreambreaker as well. That one is for sure one of the harder ones.
Yeah, this is the last one I want to talk to you about, because I do think right in the middle of the record, here's Jeff Tane Watts also, that you put total... just assassins, all of them.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And it's really hitting moment in the middle of the record.
That's the heart of me. You know, like whenever I bring, like I had Tane on Phoenix Reimagined, that's what I was thinking in my head, but that was with Scofield, so it was different and Brandy. Mm-hmm. But when I hear, because I'm such a Kenny Garrett admirer, Tane is the drums I hear in my head. When I hear that particular type of connection, I can only hear Nat Reeves, Kenny Kirkland, and a certain type of thing. So whenever I call him, it's because it's almost crucial to like my soul that I have some experience playing and trying to navigate around what somebody that I feel has done so much for. So even just playing with him and feeling that, I don't even know if he knows how much it's impacting me or helping me or whatever. And I'm like, you know, just solo over my track. It's fine. It's totally cool. You know, but to be in a room with that, to me, reminds me of that real New York jazz scene. That you gather these killers, you get together for a gig, Sweet Basil or something, and you guys just go completely to town. And when I thought of those particular people, even when I came in the room and the cameraman came in, he was like, oh, this is what we're doing. I was like, this is definitely what we're doing. He knew that it was going to be pretty wild.
Well, and it is difficult to make a record that plays in all these different styles. As you said at the beginning of the conversation, you were thinking about people that are beyond genre or whatever.
But I didn't think you noticed that. I mean, I don't know yet, because like I said, it hasn't come out yet, but I wondered if people would notice. Would they say it's a jazz record, or would they say, you know, I mean, to me, it's clearly a jazz record, but for some people it might be like, oh no, I kind of hear it's all possible forms of jazz.
You know, this conversation is getting harder and harder to have, and maybe less and less productive, because but there's a thing in the presentation of the record in the press release or whatever. It says basically like, this is a record that is definitely a signal of what's been happening at jazz festivals all over the world. Like, so to the extent that this is music that is totally appropriate at jazz festivals, then it's a jazz record. You know, I mean, there's plenty of non-jazz records that get, and artists get booked at jazz festivals too, but like, how do you even have this conversation anymore? But yeah, I think it's a jazz record.
I always leave stuff like that up for critics and other people.
Yeah.
But my definite intention, I at no point in time was like, hey guys, we're doing something completely different. I would have let them know like, hey, we're going, you know what I mean? Get it together. If you got a ride on every song and you got acoustic bass, walking, you know, that's how I felt about it. But you know, I do realize that like, I was just trying to make a record that reflects the reality of right now. And when I go to Newport, when I go to Monterey, this is the right now that I hear. And this is the, and even when you turn on the regular, when something's not a jazz record, if I turn on the regular radio, do I hear this? No.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I heard an interview with a friend yesterday or the day before, and he said this thing that really did make me think. He said, nothing sounds older than what was new last year.
And, my God, that's so true.
And I thought that we always have to keep that in mind when making work that's about right now, because if it's about right now, if it's about right now in terms of the sound of right now, then it runs the risk of sounding old in the future. But if by right now we mean it was made with a focus on being totally present in the moment when it was made, then right now is always happening.
We're in an evolving world.
Yeah.
I don't have tons of life, but I never thought I would wake up and not know, like have to turn on my phone and think, what is going on today? And it seems that because we are traveling all over,
yes,
the reality is different everywhere. And it's yes. impacting me. Like yeah. every time I go to a new country, it pops up on the news about a week before that, yeah. oh, hey, they did not have gas. So I have to ask, can we go to this gig still? That's a reality for everyone now that we all wake up collectively and go, okay, let's have a cup of coffee or tea and let's see what we can get through today. You know, and I think that that feeling, even though it's so hard on the brain, and so there is an urgency that comes with not knowing tomorrow.
Yes.
And I think there's positivity in music where you don't know where are they coming from now? What song is next? What's going on? What's going to be happening? You know, we just know this is the brand you have. So we just have to get real comfortable embracing that for what I anticipate at least 5 years.
I mean, we don't know. And at that point, like this idea of return to normal, that normal will be gone. There will be nothing to return
to. No. What do they say when you're trying to change a habit, that if you do something like 22 days or a certain yeah. amount of time, it's your reality? We're in, this is our normal.
Then that's our reality.
This is our reality. And you can yeah. expect that yeah. there will be no, what you think, better yes. normal times. It is only what was.
Yeah, that's right.
You can only you can only build a new world you want to see.
Yes.
That's why I put new world at the end. I thought it was like a breath of fresh air.
Yes.
For after that whole project of like going through my moods and everything that's going on. And, you know, I've got complete hitters nonstop attacking you.
Yes.
But I thought it would be great to like end in a place where you could think about what is the new world that you want.
Yes. And in spite of everything, we persist. We have to keep going. And we do it through a certain kind of joy and celebration of life, which I think is part of what you're saying here. Is like, yes, it's messed up, but we are alive.
Yeah. I mean, I could have called it Keep Dreaming. Yeah. I really focused on the we aspect of yeah. having this group of people of trying to embrace and talk to the collective.
Yeah.
Like, we get it to decide what we're dreaming about. Like, to somebody, this album could be, you know, Lakeisha's dreaming about positivity and bringing joy into the world. And to somebody, this could be Black Mirror. We're all chained up in pods in the Matrix, and we're in a fake world. Like, so you don't know what we're thinking.
Well, Lakeisha, thank you for dreaming, and thank you for this time. This has been such a treat. There she was, my friends, Lakeisha Benjamin. So much fun to talk to. I'll be back again in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.